Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. This season, we're talking to the keynote speakers from ISF's 2021 Digital Congress. In today's episode, ISF CEO Steve Durbin speaks with Dr. Sadie Kreese, a professor of cybersecurity at Oxford University. Dr. Kreese is the founding director of the Global Cybersecurity Capacity Center at the Oxford Martin School and a member of the World Economic Forum's Cybersecurity Center's Strategic Advisory Board. She and Steve discuss the current threat landscape, deep machine learning, and educating business leaders on the basics of cybersecurity.
Sadie, lovely to see you. Thanks very much for stopping by and talking to me. A whole range of different things that I wanted to cover with you today. I mean, you spoke at our digital congress not so long ago, back in October, on ransomware. And some really fascinating things that you talked about there, I know that members were very, very interested in. So I want to just cover off some of those things as well. But your research that you do at Oxford takes you into all sorts of different areas, artificial intelligence, the insider. So if we've got time, I'd like to try to get around some of those things. But just to start off, you know, your research, as I say, does cover risk analysis. It does look at malware, ransomware, threat detection in particular. So what's your assessment of the current threat landscape?
Well, some things are as they have ever been, but I suspect that the thing I think is perhaps most significantly worrying is actually the supply chain attacks. And the reason why is because what we're seeing there is an exploitation of attack surface that is not about technology only, it's about these relationships. And that's very sophisticated and very hard to counter. Most organizations, they spend years cultivating partnerships, relationships, they sign contracts of service. As you know, it can cost an awful lot to go through a procurement process. So there's going to be a certain amount of pressure to almost disbelieve the fact that there's vulnerability there.
Right.
So an element of delusion, perhaps it's not going to happen to me. And I almost feel it reminds me of the year 2000.
Okay.
And in the year 2000, if you went to go and sell managed intrusion detection systems, if you weren't talking to a firm that had been hacked, you didn't stand much of a chance because people in those days felt that perhaps it would never happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps they'd never get hacked. Whereas now, everybody's getting hit, and we're getting hit at home, in our personal lives, at work. You know, most people we know would have been subjected to some phishing attack on their email at some point, even if they don't work for a company that's been hacked. And so it's become normal for people to try and hack you. And so you can kind of admit it to yourself and you can admit it to others. And that's actually the first step, I guess, in making sure you take action. But there's something about these supply chain attacks. There's something about getting inside not just trusted relationships, but in certain circumstances, the very processes that sit beneath our cyber defense, patch management, that we don't scrutinize in the same way. And it converges with the research we're doing on insider threat too.
Right.
Because, of course, we're so dependent on our security teams, aren't we? And we need what they do to be effective. We need to place our trust somewhere. You have to bootstrap it somewhere.
You do. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting you talk about supply chain because I've been surprised. I mean, when I think back to when the ISF started talking about supply chain, gosh, it must have been about 6, maybe 7 years ago. And at that point, I thought this is going to be huge. You know, we're going to have people rushing to look at this. And yet there wasn't that big uptake.
Same thing, yeah.
And now
there's an idea and then it goes...
Yeah, and it's taken that amount of time. And I wonder how much of that is down to the pandemic, where some of those traditional ways of managing supply chain were taken away. So I couldn't physically go and do my audit, for instance.
Yeah.
I had to do it remotely. Do you think that had something to do with it?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, the transition to cloud would have done that earlier, wouldn't it? That back in the day, we always used to say, did we not, that you should go and see the environment and check that they have the same culture as you and that they were putting access control where you would and et cetera. And they would employ the people and in the right way. And of course, when we moved to cloud, a lot of that went out the window.
Yeah.
Same with the kind of app store mentality.
Yes.
People constantly downloading software. They don't know who wrote that.
Yep.
And they're totally dependent upon the app stores to ensure that that stuff's not malign. And we know that that's not always the case. So, but you're right, there's something about the pandemic. I think it's this perfect storm. And if you're into extorting money by damaging and then reversing it, like with ransomware, mm-hmm. and somebody increases their dependency on it, they will pay you more.
Right.
And so in general, I suspect it's that the pandemic, as you say, created a massive transition into things like cloud that supports working from home.
Yeah, it did.
Didn't it?
Absolutely.
And so it created more dependency fast. So a lot of organisations were doing a bit of it, but not everything.
Yeah.
And so suddenly we had to scale. Very hard to do, even with the clever professionals we have, to work out how to scale the security architecture in a way where people do what is needed. Because suddenly we're saying that way you behave in the workplace, you have to behave in your living room.
Yep.
So back to the whole human technical stuff,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something in that. And I think that because there's immense stress, immense pressure, and also let's not forget in the pandemic, if we're talking about cyber criminality, my understanding of these kinds of threats is they have always have more than one source of income, and it may not be all in cyberspace.
Yep.
If you're running logistics, you can run logistics for all sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in a lockdown, suddenly all these other ways of doing business are taken away. So perhaps that also explains it, that the, you know, one of the ways to make your money is to commit cyber attacks in various ways. Right?
And it's so easy, isn't it? Because, you know, you've got crime as a service, you just hop on the web, you pick it all up, and so on. What do you think the answer is, though?
To which pit?
Exactly. Where do you start?
But,
you know, people listening to this thinking, okay, well, we're very aware of what the problems are. Mm-hmm. But in the sort of research that you're doing, you do all the simulations and that kind of thing, any sort of, you know, gleam of hope out there that you can share with us?
Yes. Well, I guess the first piece is we always look to assuming compromise. So to focus on resilience, focus on working through. So of course you prevent as much as possible, but you don't just prevent as much as possible to avoid it. You prevent it because the reality is there's stuff you can't, and you need to focus all your attention on dealing with the stuff you can't prevent. And if you can cut away the noise of stuff mm-hmm. you can prevent, then that makes that job easier. And we see that in so many different ways. We see that when we talk to organizations, companies about how they conduct their cyber operations, but we also, by the way, see it inside the data when we're looking at threat detection. And of course, as you'll know, and everybody that will be listening to this podcast will know, that hiding inside noise is actually an old aspect of cyber attack, mm-hmm. right? That we've always seen that, haven't we? So do something over here, draw everyone's attention over here, so the real thing that's going to happen that's really bad is over here. And in a way, the prevent helps us cut down on the noise. But trying to move mindsets to a position where you are resilient, where you will do your level best, but you accept that something bad's going to happen and you prepare,
mm-hmm.
and to invest in properly trying to detect that as soon as possible so that you can contain the harm, whether I'm looking at data, whether I'm looking at protocols or people or routine, that's always the end point, whether it's inside a threat or outside a threat. So there's one insight. On the agent-based simulation, so we've been doing this work trying to understand how the systemic case could unravel and what opportunities we have to work at a community scale, a global scale, outside a single organization. So we built these agent simulations, and when I say an agent, I'm talking about technology. So this is just a way of modeling a system of moving parts where each part can kind of behave independently.
Right.
So in that terminology, you'd be one agent, I'd be another, I might have 10,000 instances of human agents,
mm-hmm.
humans with agency, models of them.
Right.
And we characterize them and we give them behaviors and they can make decisions and move through states. And I talked about this in the ransomware piece and on one of the slides. I used it as wallpaper, but it actually shows one of the state machines for an organization that might be subjected to a ransomware attack. But we can play these simulations where we can create models of whole populations, and we can say 50% of them are brilliant at cybersecurity. They'll be totally patched. They'll do all of the cyber essentials, practice good cyber hygiene.
Those are the ISF members.
Right, there you go. Yeah, so 50% of those. And then there's like 10% who don't care at all. They're wide open. They've not locked anything down. And we kind of divvy up populations, and we have to base that on real data. So we look around and we say, what's the evidence? who's saying what, how many people behave like this, how many people behave like that, hive up the population, and then we stick in some bad agents.
Right.
And we say, okay, you're one of those threats. Okay. And we motivate them. It's a bit like a game, really. We can make them be more interested in someone that's making lots of money, mm-hmm. more interested in an organisation that's bad at cybersecurity, more interested in an organisation that's in that sector or that sector, and we play it out. And one of the insights that's been particularly interesting was this issue of, it's always been an intuition in our community, hasn't it, that we need to share information.
Yeah.
We've done it for years,
yeah.
Particularly around threat and the specifics of the attacks we're seeing so that our fellow members of our community can learn from that and hopefully stand in their way. And that's an intuition that's always stood with us, and it feels obvious. And to more or less, we can kind of demonstrate that. But there's this other piece when we were looking at ransomware and mm-hmm. The self-propagation characteristics. And actually, the thing that had, this is still not finished, this is research,
right,
but
okay.
What's emerging, what the data appears to be telling us, and we've got lots more simulations to run, is that actually having propagation controls has a greater impact on the outcomes in general for everybody than the information sharing, unless the information sharing can happen at such a speed, obviously, it gets ahead of the threat propagation. Mm-hmm. But even when you layer and we take account of different propagation characteristics and different behaviours in information sharing, it seems that if there was one thing, so rather odd, because of course it goes takes us back to very old school mechanisms, mm-hmm. quarantine,
yeah,
and the ability to wear masks,
yeah.
Okay, and it does seem to have, the data at the moment is telling us it has a really significant impact, even when you compare it to systems that have other measures in place. So, but the information sharing, if we can get it right, is dramatic. It has, so the propagation control, it kind of limits, seems to slow things down, so you can try and get some controls around the kind of global community. But if we got the information sharing right, at such effectiveness and speed, then there's this kind of acute case where it just, you almost don't need to do propagation control because
okay.
you've gapped it so much.
Right.
So we're not finished with this, we're not done with this, but it's interesting, and it's interesting to play out these different characteristics. Of course, it would be interesting, wouldn't it, to be able to play out the consequences of payment strategies at a community level.
But presumably that's the next step, is it? I mean, you must be thinking about doing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But it's incredibly important, actually, because of the systemic characteristics now of cyberspace, because we are all interdependent. We
yeah.
are actually use common technology. There's a few big cloud service providers and then lots and lots of others that build on top of them.
Yeah.
And actually, when you look inside the supply chains of the cloud, there's lots of interconnections,
yeah,
aren't there?
Yeah.
So that's hugely complex. And then when you layer in the human and the organizational and the temporal aspects, being able to think about this and not imagine that you can deal with it in isolation is incredibly important. So we're very focused on those kinds of tools because it's not possible to be a fortress.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we were to consider just the Internet of Things and ubiquitous kind of connectivity, the notion that you would know exactly where the edges were of your system and you could build massive walls, we can still build walls, and we will, and we should, because it will slow everything down, right? But they're going to be kind of ethereal. They're going to be coming up and down and moving around all the time. And it's going to be much more dynamic. And that will be the name of the game, won't it, for our profession in the future. We'll yeah. be conductors of orchestras.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, for me, again, it's all about the data, right? It's about understanding which is most important to your organisation. We talk about it a lot as protecting the crown jewels. And,
yes.
Yeah, it's nothing new. But what your research has done as well is also introduce this notion of cyber value at risk, which I find fascinating. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And actually, what that's really doing is it's observing that even after we've done our best with all the controls and the knowledge we have at the moment at our disposal, so take all the big standards, there's commonalities, whether they're frameworks or standards for cybersecurity, they have common stuff. Know your assets, know your crown jewels,
yep.
do your risk assessment, protect access, all that kind of thing. So there's differences, there's nuances, but there's commonality. But we have to recognise as a community that even after we've done all of that, we still have attack surface.
Mm-hmm.
We still face a very creative threat.
Yep.
There doesn't appear to be a slowing of that. It appears to be growing. in probably in line with our appetite for technology,
yeah.
which is not going to stop because
right.
look at the way it saw us through the pandemic.
Yes.
And the way it helps us with predicting climate, and yep. it will deal with food security, and it will help deliver smart cities and look at how we can be greener and protect the planet. So technology is here to stay. But what we're trying to understand in the context of cyber value at risk is, what is your residual risk exposure, even after you've done all these things? And also to do that in a way that appreciates that you don't just want to work with the worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the sum of all fears, that bad stuff can happen along the way and it doesn't take down the entire system. And so what we have to do is think about very carefully what kinds of threat we face, how they can propagate through the system, how then the losses and the harms can ripple, which they do.
Right.
So one can lead to another. And then to take account of that in such a way that we can estimate the probability of your residual risk, your value at risk, so that organisations can make some decisions, really, about what they should be spending. And actually, to be able to, you can imagine being able to do that in a way that was driven by threat intelligence. So you could reassess. You could do this based on certain threats that you now think you care more about. It would also, if you discover that your crown jewels aren't the crown jewels, and actually there was something over here that you had missed.
Right.
Very important to get a hold of that. So built into that, actually, is this understanding that our understanding, in fact, not just our understanding, the reality of our systems changes. What we do with technology changes. Our businesses change.
Yes.
Even a very simple acquisition and merger scenario, that taking in a whole other organisation and all the people and mm-hmm. the customers and the partnerships and all of the physical and digital assets that come with that, the processes, the secrets, the things you want to protect. We change. In fact, I'm fast coming to realise that the reality is that it's been so fast, I appreciate that computers have barely been on the earth compared to humans, right?
Yeah.
So in the context of thinking about this in relation to mathematical science or physics mm-hmm. and understanding the universe and things, it's so new, as a child. But it's happening at such a pace that we are growing these systems that, frankly, are more complex than any human being can get their head around.
Yeah.
So they feel almost organic.
Mm-hmm.
They feel, even though they might be made of lots of different parts that are well engineered, when you compose them all together, stuff happens. There's this weird emergence. In essence, it's almost like a cyber humanity. It would be impossible to think about us taking technology out of it. It's very challenging. If you start thinking about actually what the system is and how it's all interconnected, and then where the harms might be, mm. and then how we might do each other harm, how what
oh, it's,
could
it's vast,
do.
Absolutely vast.
It's incredibly complex.
It is, hugely. And I particularly like your emphasis on the word value, because I think that if we look at, you know, the history of risk assessment, then we started with a qualitative approach. We moved to a quantitative approach. Now, you know, actually, we need to be looking at the value of what we're doing in the business.
Yeah.
And that changes, as you point out, on a second-by-second basis. One of the pieces I'd like to ask you about, because my mind immediately went to it, particularly when you were talking about speed of change and so on, was artificial intelligence.
Mm.
You know, that whole sort of machine learning AI piece, which, on the one hand, has immense benefit from a security standpoint, you know, removal of all of some of the more mundane things so that we as individuals can focus on things that we're good at, machines focusing on what they're good at. But AI, yes, could be for good, also for bad. I know you've got views on that. So,
yeah.
So tell me about that.
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is this. I began life as a philosopher interested in AI. So for me, we're not really talking about artificial intelligence. We're talking about today's deep machine learning, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So we've been looking at that, and there's certainly lots of evidence of how these techniques are going to help skill up threat actors.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. If you just think about basic kill chain, starts with reconnaissance. That's all about collecting data on us, making sense of it, working out how to attack us, predicting where we'll be vulnerable, developing the best cyber weaponry to get inside our systems, and then having to persist and evade detection. Well, that would need predicting what we were going to do in terms of cyber mm-hmm. defense. That would optimize that. Well, anything that involves trying to make better predictions, understand the world, and therefore know that if you do this, then this might happen, deep machine learning is going to help if you can get the data points, because that's what it's designed to do. Build a model of the world, start making good predictions based on the data. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of work going on, and people we speak to say there's evidence, even in some terrorist groups, of them being interested in skilling up,
okay,
developing the capacity to use this kind of tooling. But just want to park that, because actually, in the process of looking at cyber futures and trying to understand whether we can carry on with the same kinds of controls and we'll get there, mm-hmm, or whether we need a creative leap, we looked at this kind of technology. And one thing's obvious, it isn't clear that our current controls are going to translate directly.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So at the moment, our best kind of security architecture deployment would try and wrap it up. It would try and say, this is a valuable asset to my organization, and that's going to be increasingly the case. People are going to use this kind of analytics, mm-hmm, to optimize systems, gain efficiencies, whatever it might be, optimize control processes. So we're going to need to protect them. They're going to be targets. And at the moment, we have no specialized way. So for example, if I can bring this to life for you, we don't have any threat detection that would tell us that our machine learning system is compromised.
Right.
So if you, right at the beginning of this chat, you said, what are you most worried about? And I, mm-hmm, said, well, complacency, people assuming it's not going to happen, and I'm a little bit, yeah, worried about supply chain because you could get in there and we won't be looking and et cetera. Well, it's in the cybersecurity operations. It's so important. We can't just assume we can engineer this stuff out. We need to try. But machine learning, as it stands now, we don't have the ops around it, do, mm-hmm, we?
No, that's
so
right.
What we're going to do is we're going to say, I'm going to build a wall digitally and I'm going to stop bad people accessing it. But as soon as you think about the insider threat, that makes no sense. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, we don't have a solution as a community.
Right.
So this is where I think we ought to put some significant amount of thought. And when you're thinking about a system that's been deliberately designed to make decisions based on correlating data across a data set that's too large for any human to do it, this is why we're going to build an algorithm to do it. If you think about that, what does anomaly detection look like? Mm-hmm. What's an anomalous decision? That's just on the decision pace. And then we know that people are researching the training of the system before it went into deployment and whether I could compromise that by giving it bad training data. We've seen research results. People are demonstrating that this is possible. Right now, they tend to demonstrate that you make a change and you can change the system. We're not quite at, I've got a well-crafted cyber weapon and I can make the system do this, but that will follow. That's an engineering problem. Mm-hmm. So we've got a number of issues, and even the development phase of these machine learning systems is vulnerable. And then we were talking to colleagues around the world who are interested in this, and it became obvious that actually there's quite a lot of deployed systems that use openly available training data, and now we can see evidence that that's been messed with,
right,
maliciously,
okay,
right? So it's a very, very worrying time. On the other hand, given that we're talking with security professionals, it's a really big opportunity for a creative leap. And so through adversity will come some amazing ideas, no doubt, that I'm sure will have a ripple consequence for some of the other ways in which we do security. Because solving this is a big challenge. And once we can get our heads around it, maybe we'll do better with the other stuff that's not machine learning.
And one of, again, the things that I find fascinating is that security, and you don't need to go back too far, security was once viewed as being this sort of dusty old topic, wasn't it, that you sort of migrated into if you weren't any good for anything else. You know, you'd done your career in maybe the police or whatever it was, and you moved into security. What we're talking about is actually a hugely dynamic, hugely, yeah, exciting, very fast-moving, yeah, space, isn't it? Yeah. And there's almost like this sort of quantum leap that people need to, yeah, make. And when I talk to business leaders, they find that difficult to get their heads around because a lot of them are still operating in that, well, security is going to prevent me from doing something. You know, yeah. I'm not going to go and talk to the security guy because I want to actually move things forward. Now, you're the course director at Saïd Business School and you run a course there on cybersecurity for business leaders. Is that something that comes up? Is that one of those challenges that you're trying to overcome there? Or?
Right. Yes, well, in a way. I mean, the way we explain the necessity of this is that cybersecurity is about enabling you to take risk.
Right.
And doing business is taking risk. So we're just trying to help you take more risk, enable you to do more business without being subjected to these kind of losses and harms that could be existential for some organizations, mm-hmm, and certainly significantly impact their operating capabilities, if not. So we take people through a learning journey, which is about not turning business leaders into cybersecurity professionals, helping business leaders lead a cyber-enabled organization and to understand really how you respond. Is this a 3 a.m. call my top team in? Am I managing an incident? Can I wait until the weekend and think about this over a cup of coffee and self-educate myself? So really helping leadership develop the skills so that they can effectively make good decisions, know how to hold to account their experts, know the right metrics to put in place, know when to act. And actually, we also talk about how you can innovate responsibly and build this in right from the get-go and to see it internalized within the strategy. I mean, I have to say, it's great that so many business leaders now, they clearly do feel they have to take action. Mm. It's not like it was 10, 15 years ago, is it? I find it hard to imagine a really successful business in 10 years with the level of dependency we have on tech, made, as you said, more acute by the pandemic, and that we won't be rewinding that.
No, absolutely.
It's impossible that people won't have thought about this. I know different organisations will do it to different degrees, but it's just impossible to imagine a successful company that doesn't have some ability to even procure some cyber risk advice. So This is what this is about. Leaders need to know when to ask for help, how much they need to know, when they need people's staff in the company knowing it, when they can subcontract it, what kinds of support team they need, who's on the payroll, who's not, who's a non-exec, who's got to be actually on the exec, And how to evolve that. The other thing actually we talk about, which I think you'll find interesting, because you mentioned diversity and things, is that we talk to people about the necessity to try and avoid groupthink.
Okay.
Because if you skill yourself up and you start assessing risk and you make plans and decisions and set aside budget, but we work in a changing world, and in order to see the new threats, you've got to avoid everybody seeing the world the same way In that environment. So we talk a lot about making sure that we have a diversity of framing in our head. It's useful to challenge ourselves with people that see cyber risk a different way, To re-ask the questions. And then if you're basing your preparations, if you're exercising, if you're considering scenarios that might occur to you, and they're underpinning your risk strategies, to revisit the ones that you assumed were very low probability, But could be very high damage, regularly, really.
Yes.
To come back to it.
Absolutely. It's an ongoing process, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not something that you do once a year, I find. You know, It is something you've got to keep doing over and over again. The other thing that I've found, I don't know whether you've seen this as well, is that when we talk about diversity, there's a huge element of culture that comes into it. Mm. So if you're a global multinational, for instance, you know, you really do need to take into account, we've talked about insider threat, for instance, you really do need to take into account how people are operating in, say, Asia versus mainland Europe versus North America. Mm. And those are some of the things that I think a lot of companies still haven't got their heads around. You know, it is about, well, this is our policy, this is our security policy, and we roll it out. But it isn't that simple, is it?
No. And actually, I would imagine even businesses that work in highly regulated sectors will still talk about the pain they have with different compliance regimes around the world. And they're even in environments where they're quite well organised and they do collaborate. No, I agree. It's entirely impossible to deal with this in isolation because, practically speaking, nobody has unlimited resource. That's my first assumption, which I think would be fair, which means you have to be able to reorientate yourself, don't you, towards where you see the biggest threats, the biggest risks occurring to you. And in order to do that, you have to have some insight into your possible future. Mm-hmm. And where better to get insights into your possible future than by sharing with people like you or organisations like you, and hence the importance of information sharing, but even further, collaborating.
We talked about a whole range of different areas, and some people will have found it, no doubt, interesting. Others will have been pretty scared by it, and others will have hopefully gone away and thought, yeah, I need to look at some of those things. We're coming to the end of the time we've got together. You know, if you could leave sort of one message with listeners, if they could do just one thing tomorrow, what would that be?
Challenging question. I think I would suggest that people go away and look at the insider threat.
Right.
I'll tell you why. Because by insider threat, I don't just mean people, I mean tech.
Right.
I mean look inside your walls. because that's where the supply chain attacks come from, that's where the old-fashioned insider attacks come from, and we know that organisations are behind the curve. So we still are too easily dependent upon the perimeter, the wall, and I think we have to challenge ourselves more. And if I only could say one thing, yeah, which I think is incredibly unfair, I think it's that. And the reason I say it's because I think it would be the most challenging, the most illuminating, and whatever people do in response to that will be the most strengthening tonic they could be taking right now.
And I think we'll leave it there. Professor Sadie Kreese, thank you very much indeed.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to this week's guest, Dr. Sadie Kreese. Next week, Steve sits down with Max McCune, a writer, consultant, and researcher specializing in innovation strategy, leadership, and culture. And here's a preview.
You are free to choose, as Sartre said. I can't tell you what to choose, but you are free to choose. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that people believe that that is the case, and the psychological evidence bears that out, when we feel strong, we feel capable of making a choice, and we are aware of more choices, we stop making the excuse that I can't, I'm too busy, right, because we know that's a choice too. And I totally feel for them. There are a lot of people in this world who are even busier than your security professionals, mm-hmm, but many of them are juggling many, many things, impossible lists, mm-hmm, impossible demands. But I think one, knowing that you are free to choose, mm-hmm, two, by dividing your timelines, your horizons into different pieces, right, we can say, how do I cope with today, but with grace? Mm-hmm. How do I not resent the interruption, because the interruption is inevitable?
We'll be back for the full conversation in a week. In the meantime, is there a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org. Which is also where you can find the catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. Find us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And if you like the ISF podcast, we'd love it if you'd write a short review. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, associate producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.